Welcome to another episode of Speed Change Repeat. Today it's only me, Jonathan. Benjamin is excused. I'm here today in the north of Amsterdam together with Vivek Makija. Hi, Vivek.
Hey, guys.
Thanks that you're on our show today. So we basically always start the same way. We ask our guests whether they could basically give us a quick story about where they come from, what has impacted their lives, and how they ended up where they are right now and what they're doing today.
All right, cool. Let's give this a shot. So I'm Indian by origin. I was born and brought up in India, a family of entrepreneurs. I have lived and worked in Europe since 2001, actually. And yeah, I started working initially in the nonprofit sector with an organization called ISEC, where I was fortunate to be on the leadership team there. And following that, I spent about 6 years in consumer goods with Cadbury's and Schweppes, doing a range of sales and marketing work. Followed that with time at London Business School, getting my MBA, where while I was doing my MBA with a couple of classmates, we founded a nonprofit in India called Dharma Life, which does bottom of the pyramid impact work in terms of driving social change through empowerment of young people in villages. And post-business school, I sort of took a diversion away from consumer goods and went into consulting. So I spent a few years at the Boston Consulting Group, which was a fantastic learning as well as very fulfilling time. And then following that, I joined Shell in 2013, initially doing a period as the global brand manager for Shell V-Power, which is our performance fuels. And following that, I've been working in the space of innovation and low emission fuels for the last now 4 years. And I'm fortunate to currently be leading the charge within our retail business for all of our e-mobility initiatives. So that's what I do at the moment.
That's quite cool. So Shell is quite a big company, and I guess most people know Shell from, well, either gas stations or just being, let's say, an oil company, the bottom. So could you maybe dive a little bit deeper into, let's say, if you say, okay, Shell Retail, and you're, let's say, doing stuff within e-mobility and biofuels, what exactly are topics that you're dealing with?
Yeah. So the beauty is that most people in the world, when they look at the Shell logo that we refer to as the pectin, when they see that, they will recognize it because they've probably driven past or driven into a Shell site at some point in their lives, right? And it's that recognition combined with the fact that not a lot of people realize that we serve 30 million customers a day. Right? We've got roughly 45,000 gas stations across the world that carry the Shell flag. That fly the Shell flag. And so to me, the opportunity to, within that ecosystem, to start the investment journey and drive that investment journey where we are very clear, we are not going to come, we're not doing e-mobility as a nice to have additional service, right? We come at this very much with a lens of, we are a retail business that serves customers' mobility needs. We have done that for the last 100 plus years. We will continue to do that for the next 100. If what a customer needs evolves from gasoline and diesel to electric charging, then we will evolve with them to make sure that the trust they've given us, yeah, we continue to live up to that trust. So specifically, what do I do now within e-mobility for retail is looking at where, in terms of which markets, where in terms of which locations do we start offering charging services? What do those services look like? Is it fast charging? Is it slow charging? How do we structure our consumer offer so that it's response to what they actually need? And then finally, how do we talk about that offer to make sure that consumers are aware that no matter what they choose to drive, they can continue to trust Shell?
That's quite interesting. If we're talking about retail, So in that sense, are we talking about the, let's say, the business within the gas stations, or what does that include as well?
So the way Shell defines retail is our global forecourt business, which is the gas stations that you see across the world.
All right. Okay. And I think it's quite interesting because if you think about, or let's say the perception that let's say a customer has about Shell, right? Or let's say if you say almost every person will recognize the Shell logo, right? The perception that people will have with the Shell logo is, of course, nowadays it's gasoline, right? And it's basically stopping to get gasoline. And I think it's quite interesting to and also quite challenging, I guess, to make that transformation. Where we talk about, okay, Shell is also doing, is referred to also to e-mobility.
Yeah.
And could you maybe dive a little bit deeper into maybe the possible future outlooks when it comes to activities that will be, related to e-mobility for Shell?
Yeah. So there was two questions there, Jonathan. First question was, how do you see consumers evolving in their perception of Shell from a gasoline business to a, you know, a mobility business? So I'll answer that one first. Right?
Go ahead.
At the end of the day, consumers, you know, with the interactions we have with consumers, we've been able to broaden our services that we offer consumers through our retail business beyond just the gasoline transaction. Right? Today, and I don't have the exact numbers on hand, but I know that we serve probably more coffee cups every day than any coffee chain in the world, right, to our consumers, because we've got 44,000 outlets. We've got 30 million customer interactions, right? I think we're one of the biggest sales channels for Coca-Cola, right?
Right.
Because consumers don't look at a Shell retail station as just a place to get gasoline. They look at it as a place where their needs, while they're on the go, can be met in a clean, safe, trusted, friendly environment, right? And it's that cup of coffee, it's that, you know, small break, it's the fact that you have a clean loo, you know, simple things that consumers have come to trust. Now, why will they see Shell as an e-mobility player? And I think over here, speaking specifically for retail, right, is that our leadership team is very clear that we're committed to evolving our energy offer to consumers beyond gasoline and diesel. Right, in Germany, for example, where you're from, we have committed to putting down close to 400 hydrogen stations. Right, this is before there's even any real scale of hydrogen vehicles on the road, because we believe that our commitment to the energy transition is more than lip service, and it gets translated into these tangible demonstrations and investments on the ground. In terms of our e-mobility ambition, we've put numbers out there specifically. Like if you think about the Netherlands, we've said that by the end of next year, we will have 200 charge posts at Shell stations that will be serving EV drivers in the Netherlands. We have similar ambitions for other markets as well. So at the end of the day, the proof will be in the pudding. Consumers will not trust us just because we say they should. They will see through our actions and through our track record of serving their needs that we are more than a gasoline business or a diesel business. And that while we have the best gasoline and diesel in the world, we will also have the best charging service in the world.
True. And to be honest, I'm actually quite excited to have this episode today with you, because with our podcast, we basically choose to have two basically focus points. Because let's say when Benjamin and I sat down and thought about, okay, why do we want to do this podcast?
Yeah.
We both said that we believe that the two biggest challenges for humanity within the decades to come are topics around sustainability and artificial intelligence. And I guess today, with you as a guest on our show, with the focus on what you're doing, I think it's quite an opportunity to talk about, let's say, the sustainability part. And you've already mentioned it now in terms of Yeah, energy transmission. I want to get your take on how you observe the current developments, let's say, within this whole, I might even call it sustainability hype, or let's say, well, this actually ongoing transmission to, let's say, a more sustainable way. May it be, let's say, on the fuel side, let's say, or transportation side, or also, let's say, on consumer behavior, for example.
That's a really
The tough question.
it's tough because everyone's opinion on this will differ, right?
Right.
It's is it a hype? Is the whole mega trend around sustainability a hype, or is it a very justified movement?
Right.
That's the question. Now, where I sit, and this is where, from our CEO down, leaders within Shell have articulated our commitment to the transition and that we will be an active participant rather than an observer. But personally, individually, right, as a parent of two young children, you do have a sense of perspective of your duty towards the sustainability of our actions. I think at the end of the day, it's not a hype as much as it is a realization that our actions have implications that have long-term impact beyond what our understanding was, let's say, 50 or 20 years ago even, right? And with knowledge comes understanding, and with understanding comes a sense of responsibility, and with that sense of responsibility comes a call to action, right? And so that call to action then gets translated into different levels, right? Organizations with the scale and the impact that Shell can have a different level of responsibility than an individual household. But everybody, I think, has most people who believe the science, and I'm definitely one of those people, believe that, we can all make tangible, how do you say it? We can all make tangible changes or choices that will reduce the implications of our choices on the detriment of the environment.
Yeah. So, what is actually, so I guess, I mean, your current role basically evolves around e-mobility as well. So, I assume you also, let's say, carefully observe what is happening, let's say, within, let's say, the e-mobility space.
Yep.
What is your perception on that, on the current developments and on where it's going?
So I think we live in a very, very, very exciting time, right? If you think about it, the last time a shift of this magnitude took place was probably when horse carriages were being replaced by motor cars,
Right.
right? And so from that point of view, I think e-mobility's moved tremendously fast in the last few years. Is there a sense of are all the problems solved? Is the perfect electric vehicle and the perfect charging infrastructure already in place? I don't believe so, but I believe that components of that perfect ecosystem are already in place, if there is any such thing as a perfect ecosystem. Battery costs are going down, which makes the ability for some of the biggest car makers in the world to offer, reasonably priced electric vehicles to mainstream households much more feasible. So I think that's a big, meaningful step that we've seen and will continue to see. I think governments have actually done a relatively good job of putting in place policies that support electrification in a lot of the Western European markets, right? There is also the element that we do live in a multi-speed world, right? So this policy that you see in Western Europe isn't the same as policy you see in markets in Africa or in Asia. But they have their own pathway. And I think just like how the mobile phone disrupted the landline business, where some households in India never had a mobile phone. I mean, never had a land phone. The first phone they had in their house was a mobile. I think you will see households in the world where the first car they will have will be an electric car. It will not be a internal combustion engine. So That's the second piece, right? The first one is the car makers and the impact that's having. The second one is the governments and the choices they're making. And I think the third side is the energy ecosystem around it, right? We're seeing so much investment in infrastructure, whether it be smart charging for homes and workplaces, whether it be fast charging for on the go. The amount of money being put into this space in order to build the infrastructure that will be needed is very encouraging, I believe. And it's across the industry. It's not just us. Of course, we have our ambitions and our investments, but I think the industry is doing phenomenal things. You know, it's an exciting time to be part of this space.
Yeah, that's true. You know, actually, I was just thinking about it. It's quite a strong strong statement that you just made, which is, of course, yes, people, or let's say, in the end of the day, people can also, let's say, participate within the change, right, to a more sustainable world. But in the end, it's, let's say, huge corporations, right, the big ones basically that are also, that basically have so much impact on, let's say, our daily lives, who need to really take action, right? And I guess there's more and more initiatives that are, let's say, being placed by organizations to, let's say, go into a more sustainable way. And I guess, for example, if you take an example of a gas station, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it starts with, let's say, the waste that is, let's say, being produced by, for example, with like coffee cups, for example, mm-hmm. right, and stuff like that. So I guess there's also a lot of room of improvement, and also where you can basically influence also the customer, right, mm-hmm. on let's say his footprint, basically. Yeah. For example, now one of I think today was there was in the news in Germany, where Germany is basically planning to give it a stop to plastic bags. Right. So initially just have no plastic bags at supermarkets. And I guess those are a couple of very strong steps that are being taken. I want to go towards the space where, because it says in your job description, it says that you're basically leading the activities for Shell Retail within e-mobility and advanced biofuels. Could you maybe dive deeper into, because I'm far from being an expert within advanced biofuels. Could you maybe give a little bit of a, let's say deep dive on that topic?
Yeah. So I don't know if it's going to be a deep dive, but at least I'll give you an initial impression, right? For the deep dive, we're going to bring in some of our technology experts who are working on the tech to produce these advanced biofuels. But the terminology around advanced biofuels is biofuels that are not necessary, that are not produced using food crops or first. Essentially, that's what the first generation biofuels are referred to. So your corn, your sugarcane, your palm oil, etc. The advanced biofuels are where we're either using waste or residues from food crops, or we're actually using materials that were never part or are not part of that food ecosystem, right? So, for example, there is very exciting technology being worked on, which is around converting municipal waste into biofuels, right? Is this technology at scale? Not yet. Does it have the potential to scale? Yes. In fact, 2 years ago now, I was lucky enough to join Robert Swan, who's an adventurer and the first man to walk to the North Pole and the South Pole, to join him on an expedition in Antarctica where we were testing our advanced biofuels. And then the following year, Robert Swan, his son Barney, and a team walked to the South Pole using only renewable energy. So there was a combination of solar and our renewable biofuels that they use to survive in Antarctica for 40 days.
Right? That sounds like a great experience.
Yeah. So I've diverged from the question around give me a deep dive on biofuels to sort of make the point that biofuels will be an important part of the energy mix, right? Because there is use cases where liquid fuels are required for energy. Right, for certain applications, and so then biofuels is essentially one of the most net low one of the lowest carbon alternatives for those use cases.
I don't want to hit you on that point, but could you give some examples for use cases or
So, for example, we at this point, yes, there is testing around aviation. We're using batteries and electric powered airplanes, but for the scale of aviation that we're used to today, that we, you know, the planes that fly us on our holidays across oceans, the battery tech isn't there yet. So for that specific use case, you will need a liquid hydrocarbon. And there's some very cool companies doing some very cool work around reducing the carbon footprint. So there's Sky Energy in the Netherlands, is a company that we work with. They're doing some very cool work around producing the biofuels for aviation, right? So that's one use case. There's other use cases where a battery in certain conditions will not work. If you're minus 30 degrees in Antarctica, a battery life is going to be impacted, at least the current battery chemistry that we work with. So there's always, and this is a sort of analogy that leaders within Shell have referred to quite often, which is the energy ecosystem will need to evolve as a mosaic of solutions. There isn't a silver bullet, unfortunately, it's not that easy. But the good news is that in that mosaic, there's a lot of very smart people and a lot of very big organizations committing energy behind each part of that mosaic, right? And so I'm optimistic about us and our energy future.
That is a good statement, but I want to put you here on the spot. You said you were fortunate enough to go on the trip to with that explorer, basically, to Antarctica. What was the biggest takeaway for you from that trip? Because I mean, it's not something that you do on every day.
It's not something you do every day. No, it's definitely life changing. And I know it sounds very dramatic. Oh, I had a life changing experience, but this was life changing.
And what's
as sense? You. When you look at the purity and the pristineness of nature in that context, and when you're there and you can see how strong nature can be when it chooses to be, and you can see how amazing the environment, the ecosystem there is, it makes you realize that there is truly something worth saving that has to be protected. It becomes like this moral call to action, this sense of duty, the sense of, you know, we cannot let this be lost. I don't know. At least that was the feeling I left with, right? And it's really weird. But and I think it was also one of the things that triggered my career-wise, my commitment to say, you know, if I put all my energy and the few gifts that God has given me towards making a positive difference in the energy ecosystem, then I think that's a worthwhile effort, at least. You know, the outcome cannot be predicted, but at least I know my efforts for a large part of my career will be committed to a cleaner energy future.
It's actually, it's quite an interesting picture that you paint here. Actually, you know what?
I'll show you some pictures. It's amazing. Unfortunately, it's a podcast, so we can't show the other people the pictures. But
well,
it is crazy.
You know what? We can post it on LinkedIn. Because if the podcast episode comes out, we'll share it on LinkedIn anyways. But yeah, you know, actually, I had a picture in mind now. Because we had like a lot of episodes where we talk, you know, more on the... So on the tech side, right, where we talk about the other point of let's say focus of our podcast.
Most of your episodes were in German, so I didn't understand them.
True that. But I can tell you, so that most of them are around the technical side, right?
Yeah.
So around like more, let's say the future for organizations,
for
but also let's say for society in regards to let's say technology, right?
Yeah.
And that focus with AI, and you know, then there's oftentimes we talk about it's always the same pictures, you know, of like big organizations and how they need to change, right? And then you basically have, let's say you have traditional organizations in Europe, and then basically the leaders of these organizations make a trip to Silicon Valley or make a trip to maybe nowadays to Shanghai or like let's say one of the other let's say
big,
buzzing places
big
in China.
Technology centers,
exactly,
in the
right?
World, yeah.
To get some sort of inspiration, you know, to get some sort of inspiration and also get that like, know, like that moment where they realize, okay, there's something going on here, and we need to implement that into our organization. And I think it's quite interesting that you paint this picture where you say, like, yeah, you know, when I was there, you went somewhere, you know, and to realize, you know, that there's something worth saving, you know, there's something that you can talk about sustainability, but then at this place you found this, like, you know, this realization, okay, you know,
it sounds quite dramatic.
It does sound dramatic, but I mean,
it's, but it doesn't comparison. Need to be, right? It's, everybody has a different trigger, right?
True. But I guess, that, you know, and then I thought, like, okay, it would be interesting to send, like, leaders of, like, big corporates, you know, if they, like, because, like, everybody talks about sustainability, to make those trips to Antarctica, you know.
To send them oil.
Exactly, to get some inspiration and, like, understand, okay, we really got to do something with this sustainability.
I think it's an interesting thought. But I think every person finds their own, every person and every organization finds their own reason to focus or, you know, define their purpose. Like, coming back to this whole concept of individual purpose and organizational purpose, which is what you're sort of referring to, you know, Shell has articulated that we're committed to finding more and cleaner energy solutions. And those words are something that are the second part of what our mission is, but the first part is, you know, powering progress together through more and cleaner energy solutions. And I think and there is this big movement about, at the moment, right, about people and organizations trying to find their purpose. Is it new? No, I don't think so. I think people have always worked for a purpose. We haven't been as good at articulating it or as focused about articulating it. But I think since the first day that some ancestor of ours got up and went to work, there was an element of purpose there. It might have been a purpose which is more, you know, micro in terms of feeding my family. But purpose evolves, and you have, you know, immediate purpose and a bit of longer term purpose. And coming to your point around how do we sort of get leaders across a range of businesses to find their sort of purpose? I don't think it's something that can be forced or sort of, it's not an external thing. I think it's something that sort of comes to life in different ways. And I believe that as an organization, our purpose, combined with the fact that every time I walk into a Shell building, I'm amazed by how much intellectual capital sits in these buildings and how many smart people are. So that purpose combined with the amount of smart people we have, I think we're in a good place. I really think so. And
I think so too, especially if you, like, because I think nowadays as a company, you know, like, there's always this, or let's say with big corporations, you know, there's always this sense of, okay, it's really hard to attract really good talent, right? Mm-hmm. But nowadays, I think if you are really able to communicate in a natural way or, like, in a real way and not this, like, fake type of... Yeah. You know, a representation, but that that people really feel, okay, this company is really striving to work towards that. I think you can really attract smart people.
Yeah.
You know, and then it goes beyond, let's say, financial compensation or whatever, you know, then it comes to that place where people don't think about, like, work as, like, let's say, traditional work to, let's say, provide food on the table, you know,
yeah,
but really in the sense of, okay, we're working towards something
to make
larger,
a difference,
to make an impact. Yeah,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And if you're, and I guess that's also just, like, because people always want to be part of a community, right? I mean, it starts at the core. It starts with nationality, right? The concept of nationality, idea of nationality, exactly. And but then also, I mean, like, if you can, and then you have, let's say, on a social level, you have, like, stuff like sports, right? Let's say clubs, right? Football clubs, for example. And then the same goes with, let's say, with organizations, right? With work. If you truly feel like you're part of an organization that, like, you want to be part of, not just because they will pay your salary, you know, then I guess companies can really...
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I think, and I can use the term your generation because we are different generations, Jonathan.
True.
I think your generation has prioritized that to a level that it is not something that the world's leading organizations ignore. When I was at the Boston Consulting Group or at Shell, I've seen a true recognition that talent requires the freedom of expression to a certain extent, but also a emotion of belonging to something that's meaningful.
Yeah, you know, it's really cool that we're at this point of the discussion or conversation. We had a really interesting podcast episode which we recorded
in German.
Yeah, unfortunately, but I'm going to tell you the essence, or let's say the important point that I want to get here. The guy is called Uli Waltinger, yeah. And I've cited this guy in probably like 5 episodes of our podcast. It's a really cool guy. And he's basically, he founded and is now heading the AI lab of Siemens.
Okay, yeah.
We were talking about the same thing, right? We talked about, okay, how it's difficult to attract, for companies to attract really good talent, especially, let's say, in the technical space, yeah. Right? And then let's say also that traditionally companies have been always thinking, okay, so we are this company, we are this brand, right? We're either Siemens or we're Shell or we're whatever brand we are. We're a brand that people recognize, and that's why people will just come, right? Because we're that brand.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not like that. You know, he says like, okay, now referring back to your generation, or let's say my generation, right? Yeah, he says nowadays, you know, if we talk to people from, let's say, the top universities or that have graduated from the top institutions of this world, or let's say have the most demanded skills, right?
Yeah.
It's not, they don't ask, like, there's certain type of questions they ask. So they don't ask, okay, what am I going to earn? They're asking, okay, the first question they ask is, what am I going to work on? What problems will I solve? And second of all, will I have the freedom to do that? So do I not have to, let's say, be involved in any politics? Now, and that's super interesting. It's super interesting because eventually, if you, especially, let's say, in the tech space, right? Let's say, sort of say, if you really want to solve big problems with technology, or let's say really do
thought-breaking stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Really cutting edge stuff, basically. Or also really just in general, if you take it, let's say, to the sustainability side, right? Just solve big problems, right? You need freedom, right? You need freedom and you need the space to do that. And that's why I think that point was...
But is it freedom, Jonathan? Or is it a combination of freedom and focus?
Okay, so...
To stay focused on the problem you're solving, but have the freedom to try and fail with different solution spaces, right?
Well, look, the thing is, you're going to be focused as well. And let's have the statement that you're always being focused when you are doing something.
Fine. Let's assume work, that's right? The case. All right.
All right. Yeah. Because I guess the problem also, let's say, with these type of labs, you know, or in general, if you're at the cutting edge, if you're doing cutting edge stuff, then focus. There might be the possibility to lose focus because, you know, there's so many different things.
Correct.
But I guess still, like, that freedom part is super essential.
Yeah.
Because if you look at it, that's where it all moves to, right? And that's how, like, big companies try to position themselves. Not, yeah, you know, lower hierarchy levels, you know, it's all like team stuff. And it goes more into that direction because...
And I don't see, I'm not an HR expert by any stretch.
Me neither.
Yeah. But I have worked with young people from different backgrounds on a range of different things. Like, I'm going to use this chance to plug the New Energy Challenge.
Go ahead.
We're just entering finals week. Yeah. And in October, we will have 5 scale-ups who we've chosen from a large, large group of scale-ups that we looked at in the new energy space. And these 5 scale-ups will come to Rotterdam for the finals in the first week of October. And there's some very cool companies that we've selected. I'm really looking forward to working with them. And there's a couple in hydrogen. There's one in hydrogen storage. There's one that's got some very innovative technology around renewable biogas generation. And there's a couple in the e-mobility e-mobility technology space, and there's one very cool business model around how we bring e-mobility to life in mobility in our markets. So these are great examples of the freedom of young people in these types of organizations looking for solutions that they believe step away from our tested way of doing things, right? But at the same time, I think each of these organizations have displayed a tremendous focus in choosing where they want to make their difference.
Yeah, I agree. 100% agree. Can you plug that name again?
It's the New Energy Challenge.
All right, cool. So it's gonna be the final is gonna be in Rotterdam.
Yeah,
yeah. You might need to send me an invite for that.
I will send you an invite, Jonathan. Don't worry. We'll get that organized.
You know, let's shift because you know we've talked about e-mobility.
Yeah.
I guess you. I assume you. Let's say you observe what. Let's say in terms of also the. Let's say the OEMs are doing, or let's say
the car companies.
Exactly,
yeah.
The car companies. So, we also got to talk about Tesla.
Of course.
We got to talk about
fantastic Tesla. Company.
Yeah. So what is your take on Tesla right now, or let's say on what they've done, and where they're heading? And let's say compared to, I guess you're also looking at the more traditional ones sitting in Germany and what their reaction has been lately.
So we work with different parts of the Shell organization with a lot of the car makers, and we have worked with them for a long period of time. So the first part of your question, Tesla. I think what Tesla has done is two big things. One, they have truly captured the imagination of the consumer and used that to get consumers to be excited about electric vehicles. And I think they were the first company to do that at a scale that matters. Right? So I think they've done a tremendous service to the industry. And these are all my personal views, right?
Yeah.
One, they've done a tremendous service to the industry. Two, I think Tesla has pushed the industry to innovate and think about solutions that probably would have come anyways, but would have come maybe a few years later. So they've brought a sense of urgency to the industry, right? When you see that the Tesla Model 3 was the number one selling car in the US or in the UK in the last quarter and these types of numbers, of course it has an impact on the mindset of the other automakers and their sense of urgency to also launch fantastic electric vehicles at, you know, competitive price points. And I think that's great for the e-mobility ecosystem. The more cars that hit the road, the easier it becomes to then see more investment in infrastructure, and then you just get that sort of virtuous cycle going. So I think to summarize, I think Tesla's done two things. One, they've captured consumer imagination and been very consumer led in even how they deliver their product, right? It's the simplicity of using a Tesla, of buying a Tesla. At every step of the process, they've focused on making it as easy as possible, which I think is amazing. It's very customer centric. And then the second thing is they brought urgency and a challenge to the industry, and they've pushed the industry, which is great.
Yeah, I have the same opinion about that. You know, right now, I think it's going to be interesting to see how they will do in the future, you know, as a brand and as a, let's say, as a company, also financially speaking. Because, let's say, if you look at, let's say, the catching up of, let's say, the traditional companies, let's take the biggest one, which is the Volkswagen Group, right?
Yeah.
And so now they've fully committed on that, right? So they go all in. They go all in on the electric vehicle. It's going to be interesting to see on how they how the future is going to look of Tesla, because like okay, yes, it's a I agree, I totally agree with that. With that conclusion that basically they paved the way, right?
So, but they've also built tremendous brand loyalty, huh?
That is true. But look, the thing is, I think what people always... I have the sense that there's a lot of dooming around, let's say, the traditional companies, you know, especially...
No, not at all. I'm very optimistic
about the traditional companies. I'm not taking that to your
You're saying the market is doom and gloom.
Exactly. But. Also, let's say, media and everyone. And I think what people tend to forget is the power that these companies have. Also the financial power, but also the R&D power, you know. And I think they can come back strong, you know. They can...
I think, see... I see your point, Jonathan.
Yeah. And
different media will choose to have different opinions on different parts of each, or different, you know, groups of each industry. And that's just part and parcel of, you know, how the media works. You are, and those opinions have some justification for sure. But as you said, there's so many elements to large global corporations in the car automaking space, and so many strengths, right? That you can't write off any part of the industry. No way. I think that's short-sighted. I think whether everyone will come back strong or with the same strength or will make the transition as smoothly, yes, it's partly R&D. It's partly financial commitment and the ability to invest. But I think, if you ask me, it will come down to leadership and it will come down to customer centricity. Who will be the next automaker to put into market a car that customers love on all aspects? Who will build that same fanatical brand love that you see with some of the Tesla drivers?
All right, you know, let's paint a picture. if you would say what is, let's say, the average Tesla owner, who is the average Tesla owner, or who is a Tesla owner,
who is it? I don't know.
Okay, so I would paint it like this. For me, a Tesla owner used to be, or let's say that
a lot of my friends are
okay, so those are, let's say, okay, especially, let's say, in the start with the Model S and Model X, right? Yeah. I mean, those are not cheap cars. Those are not cars for the masses, right? And the plan was, I mean, the plan was free and was, okay, we're gonna let's say, put these models on market.
Yeah.
And then with the Model 3, once we have the finances, we'll put one out for the masses.
And I think that's something that all of us can learn. The simplicity of that plan, the way it's written. Of course, there's thousands and thousands of pages of complexity behind it, but we don't see that. But the simple articulation of, we're going to launch a world-class sedan in the Model S. We're going to launch a world-class crossover / SUV with the Model X.
Yeah.
And with the... Once we have the scale and the ability to scale and the finances to support that, we're going to launch a mainstream car that will make every household consider an electric vehicle. And, you know, on those three boxes, yes, there have been challenges with the finances and, you know, there's a lot of people in stock markets around the world smarter than me who've discussed that a lot. I'm not going to go down that road. It's not my area of expertise. It's not what we're talking about. But in terms of the fact that there is now a reasonably priced Model 3 available has also triggered a lot of other car companies to launch reasonably priced electric vehicles, which is great.
Yeah. You know, I think in the end it comes down to, it's the same thing. Look, it's again comes to brand perception, right? Look, if you, for example, if you take Volkswagen, right?
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't buy a high-class Volkswagen, you know, like a...
Why not?
Because that is not what you perceive with the brand. You would buy a high-class Audi or a high-class BMW or a high-class Mercedes.
The Audi is part of the Volkswagen group.
Yes, it is part of the Volkswagen group, but it's not the same brand.
I think the Golf is one of the classic cars of our lifetime.
But it's not a high-class car. It is the car for the every...
That's a matter of taste, right?
Might be.
And it's a matter of perspective, and it's a relative choice. There's a household in, and I can talk about India because I've lived there for a large part of my life and I understand the market. For a lot of households in the world, you know, in, let's say, rural India, the Volkswagen Golf is the ultimate dream car.
Yeah. I guess that is market perspective.
So it's relativity.
That is market perspective.
And again, I think it is if, so, and Volkswagen does a great job on a lot of fronts. So I wouldn't. I think, as you said, they're committing to the electric vehicle platform, and I'm excited to see what comes out of that.
Yeah, I think we can put a tick on that box, you know. But it was I think a topic that we needed to talk about. Let's see what the future holds on that. I think we still got a couple of minutes left to go. I don't want to put you too long on this. So I want you to look in the future. We've talked about, let's say, the Shell gas stations. Mm-hmm. What does a Shell gas station look in 10 years?
In 10 years?
Or let's say, okay, let's make it a little bit more, in 15 years. What is different?
So, you know, we have these scenarios teams in Shell that we're quite famous for, that look out on various aspects of how the world will evolve, right? And I think one thing that we cannot deny is that in a 15-year time frame, we will see, one, a population surge, or not surge, but a meaningful increase in population in areas like India and Africa. We will see more demand for energy. We'll see more people buying their first bike or their first car or their first, electric vehicle, for that matter. So the gas station in 15 years from today will continue, in my mind, to be what it is today. And I always use this example, so it might be a good one to end on. You know, I'm one of those people that when we go on family holidays or when we drive, I wait to refuel my vehicle till the warning light is on, right? And it annoys my wife no end that I'm doing that, right? And I'm always kidding that I like living on the edge. But it's not. It's just, you know, different people. But when I am driving with that warning light on, and I look in the distance and I see the yellow and red stripe, it's that moment of trust, knowing that, you know what, it's all good.
That could come right out of a commercial.
it's all good, right? It's all good. And that comes from the fact that we have been that beacon of trust for consumers in their mobility energy needs for the last 100 years. And in 15 years, my view is that's not going to change. Whether you're driving a gasoline vehicle or whether it's your battery level that's showing low, or whether it's your diesel vehicle, whatever you choose to drive.
Yeah.
Or your hydrogen vehicle. When you see that yellow and red stripe in 15 years from today as a consumer, it will give you that same sense of trust and confidence.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting? You just mentioned emerging markets as well. You know, like, especially, yeah. I think it's a perfect opportunity because given your background, India and Africa. I mean, you are looking at probably are looking at the emerging markets and how they evolve, right?
Yeah.
You cannot neglect those markets, right? With the populations they have and how they grow, and the pace at which they grow.
Yeah.
And especially looking at, let's say, if you look at Africa, it's super interesting to see,
and super diverse.
Super diverse, yeah. Super diverse, especially India. You know, if you would, yes, Africa has a lot of countries, but then if you look at India, right? India as one country. Being also so diverse, right? Super interesting. But what if you look at Africa from what you can read up on media, right? And is that they have basically jumped over a couple of technological developments, right? They didn't have any phones.
Which is the landline example I was giving earlier.
Exactly.
Right? You move straight to mobile.
They move straight to mobile.
So
and
there
now
will be.
There's a couple of countries, and like that is. I mean, if you think about it, it is just it's crazy. There's countries in Africa. There's a couple of countries in Africa where they basically already, let's say they have the magnitude of mobile transactions they have compared to, for example, Germany.
Yeah, as a percentage is
insane.
Yeah.
Is insane.
Yeah, but this is you're right. This is what makes technology such an exciting space to be in, right? And the fact that it gives you the ability, and I think you used this language when you were talking about what young people are looking for earlier. If you use technology to solve real consumer problems, a lot of amazing things can happen. Technology is not an end in itself, right? It has to be used to solve a problem. And so will there be, families in, let's say, Tanzania or families in Congo that their first vehicle will be an electric vehicle because they'll skip the internal combustion engine? Maybe. I believe so. But time will tell, right?
True that. We're almost at the end. We always have one last question that we ask our guests. It's always the same.
All right.
The beginning is always the same, and the end is always the same. And normally, Benjamin is always asking that question, okay. But now today he's not with us, so it's on me. And so we believe that the people that, let's say, that work on shaping the future,
yeah,
right, are also the ones that, to a certain extent, are also able to somehow predict it. Or let's say, at least they have predictions, what they think will happen. Whether these will come true, I mean, that is just for the future to tell, right?
Yeah.
But we always ask our guests to give us one prediction on something that will happen within a given time frame of their choice.
So I choose the time frame.
You choose the time frame, and of course, don't make it totally easy one. Like, yeah, within 100 years, we will have only electric vehicles or whatever.
Is that an easy one?
Or I don't. Is it? Well, I would say.
I don't know. I could predict that you'll be at the New Energy Challenge in Rotterdam next month.
Yeah. Well, that is an easy.
That's
one
an easy
as
one.
Well.
Yeah, that's an easy one. But based on everything I know, I would predict that by 2030, about 25-30% of the cars on the road in Western Europe will be full battery electric. So zero emission vehicles.
That is an absolute concrete stat.
Yeah.
That has been the most concrete prediction any guest has given us up to date.
Maybe we need to edit that one out then.
No, but I'd stick
with it. I'm really optimistic that as the energy players, we're committing to it.
So
we're investing.
Third.
A third, yeah. Let's say a third.
By 2030?
By 2030.
Jesus, that's like 10 years, right?
10 and a half. Maybe that's too optimistic.
No,
but I think if you're going to make a prediction and put something out there, then it should be an optimistic prediction.
True. We're going to leave it like that. I'm not going to comment on it. Because
you just did, but okay.
But it's we want to leave it with that. So by 2030... One third of the vehicles on the road will be electric.
In Western Europe.
Western Europe.
Western Europe, North America.
All right. That is so precise, but it's good. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Vivek, thanks for being on the show.
Lovely talking to you. All right.
Bye-bye.